This is a Triple J podcast.
I don't know if anyone else has noticed this, but people are pretty mad online. There's a lot of arguing, name-calling, outrage. It feels a bit toxic. So what's behind it? According to one communications expert, it's not just the state of things in the world and people's genuine frustrations. He says anger is now the currency of the online world, and everyone from social media giants to politicians to influencers are profiting off making you furious. I'm Dave Marchese with Hack's Long Listen of the Week, diving into angertainment. So what does that even mean, angertainment? According to Ed Koper, it's the outrage industry, and we're all falling victim to it.
I'm ringing the alarm bell. The way that we have these important debates in society, that's changed dramatically in the last few years, not in a good way.
Now, Ed knows a bit about social media, about politics, because he was involved with growing the progressive political movement GetUp. He's worked for the Labor Party over years, and he says he knows firsthand the impact and the damage that rage baiting is having on society.
Why are we in this predicament? The big tech platforms make a lot of money. All these tricks are just about keeping us scrolling.
And Ed says a lot of us don't even realise that our emotions are constantly being manipulated online.
That we're always under threat, and it's a terribly exhausting and terribly draining and a negative experience for us to be collectively in that state the whole time.
It definitely makes you think, this chat. What is genuine? What is not? Who has vested interests online? And has social media outrage really ruined everything? So here it is, my chat with Ed Koper about his book, Angertainment. Ed Koper, welcome to Hack.
Thanks, Dave. Great to be here.
I mean, rage bait, I guess, is nothing new. We've seen for decades talkback radio tabloids have really traded on provocative headlines and angles that will provoke people. What do you think has changed here?
Yeah, look, rage bait isn't new because our emotions aren't new. So part of this story is very ancient. It's just about how we're hardwired as people. And if you wanted to get attention or political currency or, you know, fame and fortune, you've always had to appeal to people's emotions. That's not new. What's new is that we now get the majority of our information from platforms that are excellent at mining those emotions and doing it in a really subconscious way. So anybody listening, don't feel bad if you've ever fallen for rage bait. It's a human reaction. It's an instinct that comes from your gut, and you can't avoid those triggers. The new thing is that the platform algorithms are all built around those triggers. And so there's so much content out there that we don't really get a choice about what comes to the top of our feed. It's the platform that decides what comes to the top of our feed. And increasingly, the quick sugar hit of anger, that's just the easiest way to get engagement. So, of course, our feeds are filled with that kind of content.
Why is it anger? Why aren't social media platforms, politicians, other people playing on some of our other nicer emotions like happiness or humour?
Yeah, and it can work with those. It actually works well for all emotions. So, you know, my feed over the weekend was full of the Socceroos victory and the Knicks victory in the NBA, and these really positive emotions, very happy emotions. They did really well in the algorithm, and they made me filled with warm fuzzies as well, and everyone had a great time. It's really hard to beat Turkey in a soccer match or to win the NBA World Championship, and it's really hard to generate those moments. That's why they're really rare. It's really easy to do the anger bit. So anger as an emotion is designed to be more powerful than our positive emotions. So if you think, why do we get angry? It's when we have to stop whatever we're doing, interrupt that, and pay attention to whatever is making us angry. So you can get there with positive ones, but anger's always going to win. It's always going to rise to the top. It's always going to interrupt whatever we're doing and trigger that kind of threat response. That's just evolution. We're triggered by anything that feels threatening.
How widespread is this style of content and angertainment, as you've termed it? Where are we finding it?
We're finding it everywhere. And I think that people will know this from their own experience on social media. It feels different. It feels like it's evolving day by day. And you're starting to see less content from your friends and family and less content from pages that you actually follow. More and more of it is suggested. And in order to win that battle for our attention, there's all sorts of cheap tricks that you can employ. And it's not just about political rage bait. That's obviously something that we're seeing a lot of. Sometimes they're just cheap tricks to make us watch to the end of a video, like there's a secret reveal that's going to come that never happens. Or maybe there's a deliberate typo. There's some other provocation. It's just a cheap trick to get your attention and to get you to engage. The user that created it wants you to comment or share or like, and the platforms want you to do the same. And so that's why we're seeing more and more of it, because it's a bit of a race to the bottom.
It's so interesting how subtle it can be as well. Like you mentioned, like a small grammatical error or something, but that is enough sometimes to get people really engaged in content and to get them fired up enough to like or to comment or do whatever they have to do. I mean, I want to get into some examples because you give a heap in the book. And one is the furor over Sydney Sweeney's ad for American Eagle last year. People might remember the jeans ad. You say in the book, like all good angertainment, it was a manufactured provocation. Why do you say that?
Well, if you think about anyone who remembers that scandal, it came to their attention somehow. It was probably by someone giving some commentary on it. Certainly for me, I never saw the ad. I saw the reaction to the ad. And the reactions that I started seeing on social media were all about everyone is outraged by this Sydney Sweeney ad. And for people who didn't see it, you know, Sydney Sweeney obviously always does well on the internet. And this was a jeans campaign that said Sydney Sweeney has great jeans, J-E-A-N-S. The outrage that everyone saw was that all of these people, the progressives, were angry that that was, you know, kind of racial coding for, you know, she's blonde, blue-eyed and white and G-E-N-E-S, yes, of course. Is she from the master race? You know, all of these kind of racial coding. And then everyone on the other side was saying, oh, you know, the left's war on hot women. You know, it's gone, wokeness has gone too far. And it just became this snowballing outrage that everyone was having an opinion on. But of course, if you forensically go through what happened, it reveals something else entirely. Nobody was actually outraged for about a week. It was only people saying, oh, this woke war on hot women. Everyone's crying tears about this scandal. There was no scandal. They right. acted as if there was a scandal. And you know what? It became a self-fulfilling prophecy. Then people did become angry about it. So you've got to look at the motivations behind it and understand that in order to win attention on the internet, people are out there every day trying to make things culture war scandals.
So do you reckon there was a marketing team behind that who were really predicting how that would play out and wanting it to play out that way?
Look, I think American Eagle probably knew it was going to be controversial, and they knew that controversy sells. It gets attention. Negative attention is just as good as positive attention. But I don't think they would have even anticipated the scale of that. And what happens away from the actual brands trying to do that is there are these networks that are built to look for the outrage of the day. And they actually throw as much stuff against the wall as possible. 99% of it you don't see because it never takes off. But 1 in 100 or 1 in 1,000, whatever the ratio is, all of a sudden something takes off and they're built to respond to that, and all of a sudden they pile on. And that's what the social media algorithm looks for. It looks for everyone talking about the same thing at the same time, especially if it's emotional. Cultural issues are great because everyone gets riled up, and then all of a sudden it cascades, it goes viral, and we are talking about it. And everyone is thinking, well, why am I hearing about Sydney Sweeney's jean campaign all of a sudden? And then people want to weigh in with their own opinions. Everyone's giving commentary on it. Everyone's giving their hot take. Everyone's trying to win that battle for attention. It started from a very manufactured place.
So it can spill over from anger, which can be a very solo kind of emotion, to outrage, which is something that a lot of people engage in and then takes off for everyone.
Yeah, and we're built to do that. Anger is like a virus. It spreads from person to person, and collective anger becomes collective outrage. Now, normally that's a good thing in society, because if something happens that violates our moral code, we get angry together. We turn it into an outrage and we express our opposition to it, and hopefully those in power listen and correct the wrong. Or even in a group situation, someone does something bad. Maybe your friend cheats on their partner and everyone gets outraged, and it's designed to correct that kind of behaviour. That's the good form of it. Unfortunately, it maps onto the same effects on social media at a global scale. And all of a sudden, those same evolutionary impulses that tell us to get together and be outraged together, they work, but it's at some imaginary scandal or blaming some problem that's not actually the real problem. It's just for the attention. It's not really about the issue anymore, but we can't suppress those those instinctual urges to get angry together.
It's all pretty exhausting, Ed, isn't it? When you think about how much we are potentially being manipulated here and our emotions are being played on. I mean, it's tiring.
We're not supposed to spend all of our time in that heightened emotional state. Yeah. We're supposed to be out there tilling the field for, you know, most of the day, and then all of a sudden, you know, a lion or a tiger comes over the hill and we pick up our spear and respond to it. You're not supposed to be constantly holding your spear out, fighting off the lions or fighting off the saber-toothed tigers. But that's what we get on social media. We really get the effect that we're always under threat. And it's a terribly exhausting and terribly draining and a negative experience for us to be collectively in that state the whole time.
Let's get into another example now. One that you gave in the book is when Great Northern, big popular beer brand in Australia, launched a campaign. Can you tell us what happened with this campaign and what the reaction was?
This is something that is happening increasingly when the outrage is turned to, say, a commercial brand. An enormous backlash in the US against Bud Light, which was the number one beer, when they gave one can in a promotion to a transgender influencer. The outrage machine went into overdrive and people wanted to cancel Bud Light, and it was really effective. They took cases off the shelves, the stock market price plummeted for the parent company. And so everyone in Australia was like, oh, maybe we could repeat the same kind of outrage here. And you have people out there trawling the internet for these sorts of things. So Great Northern, what was their great sin? If you've seen their kind of marketing campaigns, it's all very outdoorsy, camping. And so they had a promotion that you could support and they would give a donation to a national parks charity to buy up some land to preserve for national parks. There was one Facebook group called Four Wheel Drive TV, full of four-wheel drive enthusiasts, who saw this as a great threat to their ability to drive their four-wheel drives. And so they did what people often do. They took to the internet to be really angry. And this took off. People did the same kind of thing, pouring the Great Northern out. It became an enormous media scandal. And of course, the brand backed out of the promotion. Now, again, there's something at play here that a lot of people didn't see. And that is, not many people actually were outraged. Mm. And the problem with social media outrage is it always appears larger than it is, and all proportion is lost. If you look over the stats on that particular campaign, the boycott hashtag was only used very sparingly by a few people. But it all of a sudden started to win the algorithm. It started to appear at the top of the feed and it appeared like it was a widely held opinion. And then, of course, the mainstream media does go and pick it up as if everyone is outraged. So the headlines that you see are things like, everyone is outraged at Great Northern, or Australians are boycotting Great Northern. And that's what has a real effect. And of course, they pulled out from the promotion and, it sends this chilling message to any brand out there that anything they do might become an internet outrage, when in actual fact, not that many people really cared.
That's so interesting. And I mean, we're also seeing that from politicians as well. Politicians have backed down from positions or, views on things because of perceived outrage on the internet. Can you talk to us a bit more about how this is playing out in politics? Like, is it only the right that's employing these strategies, or is it the left as well? How is it playing out?
Well, it always, for politics to work properly, decision makers have to be able to accurately gauge the level of outrage in the community. And this is the feature that's kind of thrown all of our democracy haywire, is that because social media preferences outrage over other things, the outrage is more likely to win, even if it doesn't represent public opinion. Now, the problem with that is there's all sorts of people have cottoned onto that. And so they know if they want to get their way politically, they just have to manufacture an outrage on social media and make it appear really big, and they will win. Now, there's one side of politics who's done this much more effectively than others, and that is generally the right, the far-right populists. These are the, people like Trump and MAGA in the US, Pauline Hanson and One Nation in Australia, Nigel Farage and Reform in the UK. These sorts of politicians are doing really well at the moment because they have captured the playbook about how to weaponize social media algorithms and make everyone really angry. Now, it's not to say that that side of politics is the only one who can do this or is better suited. it's kind of agnostic. Anyone with any ideology, with any idea can do this. It's just that the first people to cotton on to how to do it and how to do it effectively have all come from that kind of populist wing of politics. And that's why we see them on the march so successfully at the moment.
And I guess, I mean, I've started to see, like, from the left as well in politics, some people employing these strategies. Maybe it's talking about taxing billionaires or that kind of thing. And in the social content, you see it starts with some spark of outrage to really get people going.
If you want to get heard today on social media, you can't just put out your policy points. You can't just put out your press release. You know, that's how politics used to work. So if you want to get an idea through, you kind of have to manufacture these outrages or else nobody will ever hear them. So if you look at someone like Zoran Mamdani, who's the mayor of New York, he is the mayor of New York because he could use social media really effectively. Now, he didn't do it to whip everyone into a frenzy to hate their neighbor. He did it with just good content and authenticity. And obviously, you have to have the substance as well and talk about that in a really digitally native way. But I think he's a good example that it's not about the policy. It's not about the ideology or where you are on the political spectrum. It's about your ability to communicate on these platforms. And if you have an idea that's worth hearing, you better get really good at knowing what the social media algorithm likes if you want anyone else to see it.
Can you explain the concept of dark woke? Because that's also something that you reference in the book.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, Donald Trump wins again in 2024 and the whole Democratic establishment just goes to pieces. They don't know why they didn't win. They don't really mount an effective response. The leaders are all out there saying, oh, we've got to respect the public opinion. Let's not just go around trashing MAGA and Trump. And there's a lot of navel-gazing. But at the same time, the people in America who were against Trump, they're outraged. They want some revolution. They want an outlet to express it. And so this whole internet culture developed, which came to be called dark woke, which was just about losing your inhibitions and memeifying that anger. And it was ridiculous. It was like, I pushed my grandma down the stairs because she voted for Trump. Or, you know, it was directly attacking them in the style that they use. And it was like water in the desert for a lot of that resistance to Trump because it felt good and it felt like they were doing something and it felt like an outlet. And then you saw, of course, and everyone got a lot of attention around Gavin Newsom, who was the governor of California, when he just started repeating Trump's incoherent rants on social media back to him. And it looked really weird when you saw someone else doing it. All caps, crazy unhinged rants, AI generated images of Hulk Hogan as an angel and just ridiculous internet stuff, stuff that goes well on the internet. And you saw that when you started putting the traditional political content in that kind of language, people really flocked to it. They felt like this is what had been missing. And I think it's a good example to think about just that the way that we talk about issues these days has changed. And if you can't compete on that terrain, you're just seeding that ground to whoever is talking about those issues. So we haven't seen a lot of that in Australia.
Yeah, I want to talk about how anger and angertainment could be influencing politics here in Australia because, you know, this week, obviously, we've got Senator Pauline Hanson addressing the National Press Club, One Nation also launching an ad campaign against Anthony Albanese that really hones in on this idea of him being a liar. How do you see One Nation employing some of these tactics in the months and years ahead heading up to the next election?
Well, it's a really useful experiment to think about because Pauline Hanson has actually been out there saying the same thing since the mid-1990s. Since then, her and her party really haven't got above 5% of the vote. And all of a sudden, all we're doing is talking about Pauline in 2026 and she's polling at somewhere around 25% of the vote. Now, what's changed? Two really big factors. The first is I think our grievances have got a lot worse and people feel like they're not doing very well at the moment. And that's the foundation that a lot of grievance politicians tap. But the other thing that's changed is we're getting our information on social media. So it has to be a factor that if you start getting your opinions from somewhere that favours fringe, extreme, emotional opinions, then of course people who peddle those are going to start getting heard. So that's what we've seen. And those two factors are really big in explaining why we're in this situation all of a sudden. Now, what are we going to see looking forward? Unless those who are competing against Pauline Hanson can also natively tap those grievances and speak the language in social media that we do, I think we're going to hear more and more from her. And a bit like You know, the example of Great Northern, where nobody was particularly outraged, then all of a sudden everyone is because the mainstream media started talking about it. The same effect happens in politics. All of the headlines at the moment are, why is Pauline Hanson so popular? Why is she the preferred prime minister? And what's the effect? People hear that message incessantly. And I know this works because I lived in America in 2016 when this happened to Donald Trump. Donald Trump was a joke when he launched his campaign and nobody took him seriously, but the media obsessed about him endlessly. And guess what? After a year of hearing about him nonstop, he won the election. That wouldn't have happened without all that kind of attention. So attention is the commodity that wins elections now, in the same way it wins, you know, advertising. So what we give attention to is incredibly important, and people who can game the platforms with cheap attention tricks, they're going to win.
So if you were advising politicians, which you do sometimes, and you're involved in politics and campaigns and stuff like that, what would you be suggesting to combat some of this stuff that you might be seeing from One National Pauline Hanson?
There are a couple of really powerful antidotes. It doesn't mean you have to adopt her style, but you need to adopt a style that will cut through. And there's some features that work really well on social media. One of them is authenticity. And sometimes that's really uncomfortable for politicians. We're used to the polished press conference. If someone comes out and says something from the heart, says something authentic, people respond to that. I mean, think about the teal movement who aren't kind of bound by the same restrictions. What do they have? They don't have anger. Their brand is not anger, but they've done incredibly well. What is their brand? Authenticity. Would I want to have a beer with this person? Mm. Are they playing me for a mug or, you know, are they being legit? And then the other thing they've got to do is acknowledge that these grievances are real. These anxieties are real that drive people to populist policies. You can't keep telling everyone how good they're doing. If you want to reassure them that they will be better off under you, I think you've got to start by acknowledging that and then go to the solutions. I think we go to the solutions way too quickly.
News consumption. Is anger and angertainment, is it influencing, yeah, the news sources people are turning to?
Absolutely. So it would be wonderful if everyone out there in Australia could tune into your program on the ABC.
Highly recommend.
And get all their opinions there, because what do you have? You're bound by standards and ethics, and you have training, and the filters that your information has to go through make it really healthy for people to follow and listen. And interesting, I will say. There's no such filter on social media. So every year, the biggest global study on where people get their news from comes out. It actually came out yesterday. And the trend continues. More people get their news from social media than news websites or traditional news platforms. And that gap has increased this year, very predictably. The new thing they measured this year is the amount of people who get their news from AI chatbots.
Oh, and what were the findings?
Disturbing.
There?
It depends on the demographic. Young people more so, but overall, I think about 10 to 15%, depending on the country, are getting their news from AI chatbots. And we'll see that increase in the coming years. So what does all that mean? The more people that get their news and information from platforms that don't have a quality filter for that information, the bigger this crisis is going to get, because angertainment wins on social media, and so that will win more and more people's opinion. That's your news source. The economy's doing bad, blame a migrant. The algorithm actually favours that kind of content. Then more people are going to adopt that opinion.
Ed, as someone who works in comms and strategy, have you ever employed some of these tactics yourself?
Don't get me wrong. I am telling you this from the trenches. I'm someone who tries to make people angry on the internet every day.
Oh, no.
I would say about, you know, very valid causes and reasons. But I get how it works. This is what I do for a living. And I'm telling you that something fundamental has changed. The playing field is not level. It used to be a matter of going out there with the best ideas and trying to compete and coming up with entertaining ways to tell them and getting through to people in a really important way. What's changed is people are not trusting information in the same way. There's so much AI slop out there that they shut off from good information, and they either question everything or they take the bad information wholesale. You know, we're really social creatures. When you see something that has a lot of likes, all right, here's a wellness influencer telling me that I should burn in tan lines with my bikini. It's got 25,000 likes. Well, it must be true. That's how we kind of accept information as social creatures. It's not a level playing field. So I'm ringing the alarm bell that the way that we have these important debates in society, the way that we try to get attention on issues and make people outraged about things they should be outraged about, that's changed dramatically in the last few years, and not in a good way.
Very sobering point you make in the book. You say social media has become a brutal machine that weaponizes our own cognition against us. This machine that covets our attention and mines our emotion is now the supreme vehicle for social control, political power, and cultural capital. Great. What do we do about it? What do we do, Ed?
Well, the first thing we can do is just acknowledge that. Well, you've got to understand that you are getting information on platforms that serve your rage bait. And so that makes you better able to spot it. If you're able to pause when you see something and say, well, hang on a minute, is this person just trying to make me angry? Is this actually legitimate? Or are they trying to, you know, that gut feeling I have, let's pause and before I go in the comment threads and shout at someone. Is someone monetizing this? You know, understanding that when you get a lot of engagement on social media, you just make money. So, of course, people are going to go out there and try to make you angry if that's how you can make a career out of it. Buyer beware when you're on social media. And the other thing we can do is, you know, once we have that understanding, lobby for solutions that fix this problem. The algorithm determines our diet of information. And at the moment, it's giving us all of the wrong type of information. So there's campaigns out there like Chanel Contos's Fix Our Feeds that says, well, why don't we have control over what we see? Why can't I take control back over my algorithm? And of course, governments have to regulate these platforms so that they're not serving us harmful information. And then you've got to support the people who are giving you quality information. Once you've determined how do I tell good from bad, if someone's out there giving quality information, keep listening to Triple J Hack. Go and pay for the Substack of your favorite creators and journalists out there on social media and, you know, acknowledge that this is really important for a society for us to have quality sources of information.
Do you see a way back? I mean, I think about, you know, the dead internet theory, stuff like that, where people say one day we'll just be swimming in all of this unverified slop and people maybe might start to abandon these platforms and there might be a real journey back to considered debate. Do you think that's likely to happen?
There will. I do think that's going to happen because why are we in this predicament? The big tech platforms make a lot of money when our engagement is kept on social media. So they, all these tricks are just about keeping us scrolling. Now, we're not going to keep scrolling the more that it is an experience of watching bots argue with other bots. We will switch off. And as soon as we do that, these platforms will have to change because they will have lost our attention. It's all about our attention. And I think just on an individual level, there's a much more of an understanding in society that there are social harms, there are mental health consequences of spending all this time doom scrolling through this apocalyptic, you know, experience on social media. And I think we're going to see a renaissance in people going out and touching the grass, having real conversations. And there's still a need, there's still a desire for people to be out there in real life. And I think we're going to see a resurgence.
Ah, time to go touch some grass. Nice to end things on a bit of a positive note. It's such an interesting read and I highly recommend it. It's not all doom and gloom. It's funny as well. And just, I don't know, just really enlightening and stuff that you might not think about on a daily basis, but it affects all of us. So it's called Angertainment, out now. Author Ed Koper, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much, Dave.
Interesting chat. Hope you liked it. And if you did, please subscribe to this podcast. Go chuck us a follow on social media at Triple J Hack on Instagram and TikTok as well. And also leave us a review wherever you're listening. Give us a rating. Because I'd love to hear what you think about these long listens. Love to keep them going. That's all for now. I'll catch you next time.